Kip was staring at Isa's body. After she'd seen the soldiers kill Ram, she looked back at Kip. She'd been looking for safety, for protection. She'd looked at him, and she'd known he couldn't save her. Kip tore his eyes away from Isa. Sanson was running toward the village. Sanson wasn't smart, but he'd always been practical. He hadn't done anything so dumb in his life. But Kip couldn't blame him. They'd never seen anyone die, either. But there was no way the soldiers could fail to see Sanson. And now he'd die too if Kip didn't do anything. Kip had stood around enough, doing nothing while his friends died. He didn't think. He acted. He ran. The other way. Kip hated running. When Ram ran, it was like watching a hunting hound speed after a deer, all hard, lean muscles and flowing strength. When Isa ran, it was like watching the deer flee, all easy grace and surprising speed. Kip running was like a milk cow lumbering out the pasture. Still, no one was expecting him. He made it to Ram's body and to full speed.
Hey, you! Stop!
He crashed up the bank of the river, barely slowing. Once he got his mass moving, it took a lot to stop him. A dead tree, its trunk rising to shin level, mostly hidden in the long grasses, counted as a lot. Tears streamed from his eyes. His hands were bleeding again, fingernails torn. They'd lost him for the moment, but horsemen were coming. He wasn't 50 paces away. The grasses were only knee high. The horsemen would see him any second now. And then he'd die, just like Isa. He staggered to his feet, his shin afire, tears blurring the world. He hated himself, crying because he fell down, because he was clumsy, because he was weak.
There he is!
The two horsemen galloping toward Kip were both part of the lower cavalry. Barely able to afford their own ponies' weapons and armor, they served only during the dry season. Amateur warriors, hoping to bring home loot and lies before the harvests. The horsemen were jostling each other for the better line, competing to see who would hack the child. The laughter did it. It was one thing to give up and die. It was something else to let some giggling morons murder you. But there was no time. The horsemen had reached a full gallop, trampling the tender, radiant green grass the way they would trample Kip. They finally split, one switching his vachevel to his left hand, so they could cut Kip down simultaneously. Kip lashed out, jumping, determined to at least punch one stupid grin to oblivion before he died. It was a poor jump, and far too early. But as Kip's body rose to meet the extended lances, a radiant green mass rose through him. He felt energy rush out from his body. A dozen blades of grass rose through his hand with his punch, tearing his skin as they ripped out of him. They thickened to the width of boar spears as green light poured from him. They became blades in truth. As he threw them into the air, Kip was thrown back down to the ground. The butts of a dozen radiant jade spears thunked into the ground around him. The horsemen barely had time to jerk on their reins before they rammed into a wall of spears. The lighter of the two caught and was held 5 feet off the ground. The heavier rider snapped off the spears and fell flat on his back beside Kip. For a long, stupid moment, Kip had no idea what had happened.
Grafter! Green Grafter!
Kip looked at his hands. Radiant green was slowly leaking from his bloody fingertips. The exact shade of the grass and the spears. There were cuts at his knuckles, wrists, and under his nails like something had ripped the skin on its way out. A scent like resin and cedar filled the air. Kip felt woozy. He turned. It was the soldier bleeding on the ground near him. Kip had no idea how the man was still alive. There were 4 spears through his body, but they were disappearing now, bowing under their own weight, shimmering as if on some tiny level. They were boiling away into nothingness. The movement made the 2 spears through his chest shift. Slowly, the spears disappeared, leaving only chalky green grit to mix with his blood. Despite the mail hanging askew across the man's face, Kip could see the gleam of his dark eyes. shining with tears. For a few moments, Kippet felt connected. The green was unity, growth, wildness, wholeness. But as it slipped from his fingers, the great spears bowing like wilting flowers, he felt alone once more, scared. The smaller rider who'd been held off the ground was released. The spear shimmered, dissipated, and blew apart like heavy dust. The bigger rider spat blood all through the mail over his face. He turned over onto his stomach, and more blood poured out of his broken body. Kip turned away. He looked toward the bridge. The king's soldiers were gone. Kip could only guess that they had assumed that some trained drafter had shown up to rescue him. Maybe they would wait until dark to come after him, or maybe they had their own drafter back at camp. Either way, Kip had to run. Fast. He turned on wobbly legs, fingers stinging, his brain thick with grief and exhaustion, and stumbled toward the orange grove. Gavin Guile plunged past classrooms and barracks, and knew that not a few people would rush to the windows to see what came next. In fact, this was the first day of drafting classes for the Dims, so he was probably about to be a perfect illustration of one of the primary lessons every Magister taught. The Magister would light a candle and instruct the students to comment on what was happening. This always gave the Magisters plenty of opportunities to abuse the bewildered children, who would invariably say,
"It's burning."
"But what do you mean by this word, burning?"
It's burning."
The eventual point was that every fire began on something tangible and left almost nothing tangible. When a candle burned, where did all the tallow go? Into power. Power we experience as light and heat with some residue. Whether much or little depended on how efficiently the candle burned. Magic was the converse. It began with power, light or heat, and its expression was always physical. You made Luxon. You could touch it, hold it, or be held by it. Halfway down, Gavin drafted a blue bonnet and a harness from the cold blue of the sky, with some green added for flexibility. It unfurled and slowed his fall. When he was a few paces from the ground, he threw down blast waves of sub-red that slowed him enough that he could land lightly in the street. The bonnet dissolved into blue dust and green grit and a smell like resin, chalk, and cedar. He strode toward the docks. He found her within minutes, just arriving at the docks herself, a bag slung over her shoulder. She'd changed from her Blackguard uniform, but was still wearing pants. Karis only wore a dress once a year, for the Lux Lord's Ball, where it was required. She'd also somehow dyed her hair almost black, so as not to stand out so much in Tyria. Of course, it was impossible not to stand out with those eyes, like an emerald sky adorned with ruby stars. Karis was a green-red bichrome, almost a polychrome. It was an almost she'd hated all her life. Her red arc extended into the subred so far that she could draft fire, but she couldn't draft stable subred Luxon. She'd failed the examination twice. It didn't matter that she could draft more subred than most subred drafters, or that she was the fastest drafter Gavin had ever seen. She wasn't a polychrome. But on the other hand, polychromes were too valuable to be allowed to join the Blackguard. She stopped and waited for him, a quizzical look on her face.
"Lord Prism?"
Evidently, she had not read the note. He fell in step beside her.
"So, Tyria."
"The armpit of the seven satrapies itself."
"5 years, five great purposes, Gavin."
He'd given himself purposes since he'd first become Prism, as a focus and distraction. 7 goals for each 7-year stint. And the first was, the first had always been, to tell Karis the whole truth. A truth that might ruin everything.
"What I did, why, and why I broke our betrothal 15 years ago. And you can rot in that blue hell forever for that, brother."
"Important mission. How come the important missions never take me to Ruthgar or the Blood Forest?"
Hrothgar was the most civilized and prosperous nation in the Seven Satrapies, and of course, as a green drafter, Karis would feel a strong fondness for the verdant plains. Alternately, the Blood Forest was where her people were from, and she hadn't walked among the redwoods since she was young.
Why don't you make it a quick trip, then? I can skull you there.
To Tyria? It's on the opposite side of the sea.
It's on my way to a color white I've got to deal with.
And I may not have many more chances to be near you.
Seems like there've been a lot of whites recently.
It always seems like there've been a lot recently. Remember last summer, when there were 6 in 6 days, and then none for 3 months?
I guess so. What kind?
Like most drafters, she felt a special outrage when a white had come from her own color.
A blue.
Ah. So I'm guessing you'll be right on your way.
Karis knew about Gavin's special hatred for blue whites.
Wait, you're hunting a blue white? In Tyria?
Outside Rue, actually.
At 32, she had the faintest lines on her face. More frown lines than smile lines, sadly. But she still had the same dimples. It just wasn't fair. After years of knowing her, a woman's beauty shouldn't be able to reach straight into a man's chest and squeeze the breath out of him. Especially not when he could never have her.
Tyria's 1,000 leagues from Rue.
Couple hundred at most. If you stop wasting daylight arguing with me, I might be able to get you there before nightfall.
Gavin, that's impossible, even for you. And even if it were possible, I couldn't ask you to...
You didn't. I volunteered. Now tell me, would you really prefer to spend 2 weeks on a corvette? It's clear today, but you know how those storms come up. I heard the last time you sailed, you got so green you could draft off your own skin.
Gavin!
Important mission, isn't it?
The white's gonna kill you for this. She's got an ulcer named after you, you know? Literally.
I'm the Prism. There's got to be some advantages, and I like sculling.
You're impossible.
We all have our special little talents.
Kip woke to the smell of oranges and smoke. It was still hot, the evening sun slipping through the leaves to tickle his face. Somehow, he had made it to one of the orange groves before collapsing. He looked down the long, perfect rows for any soldiers before he stood up. His head still felt foggy, but the smell of smoke drove away any thoughts of himself. As he approached the edge of the orange grove, the stench grew stronger, the air thick. Kip caught flashes of light in the distance. He emerged from the grove and saw the sun setting behind the Alcaldesa's mansion, the tallest building in Rectan. As he watched, the sun went from a beautiful deep red to something darker, angry. Then Kip saw the light again. Fire. Thick smoke billowed suddenly into the sky, and as if on signal, smoke billowed up from a dozen places in the town. In moments, the smoke blossomed to raging fires, towering dozens of paces above the roofs. Hundreds of foot soldiers surrounded the town in a vast, loose circle. As the flames drove some townsfolk from their hiding place, Kip saw King Harald's horsemen set their lances. It was old Miss Del Clara and her 6 sons, the quarrymen. The biggest one, Mikael, was carrying her over one burly shoulder. He was shouting at the others, but Kip couldn't hear what he was saying. The brothers ran together toward the river, apparently hoping to find safety there. They weren't going to make it. The horsemen lowered their lances as they reached a full gallop, maybe 30 paces away from the fleeing family.
No!
5 of the brothers dropped to the ground. Zalo was too slow. A lance punched through his back and sent him sprawling. 2 of the others were skewered as their pursuers quickly adjusted their aim and caught the men low to the ground. Mikael's pursuer dipped his lance too, but missed. He caught the ground instead, and the lance stuck. The horseman didn't release his lance in time and was slammed out of his saddle by the force of his own charge. Mikael ran over to the fallen soldier and drew the man's own Vecheveril. With a savage chop, despite the layers of mail, he nearly cut the man's head off. But the other horseman had drawn rein already, and in seconds there was a forest of flashing steel blocking Mikael, his brother, and his mother from Kip's view. Kip felt like he was going to throw up. At some signal he didn't see or hear, the horsemen formed back up and charged off toward new victims in the distance. Kip was only glad that they were far enough away, but he couldn't recognize them. Around the rest of the town, the foot soldiers were moving in.
Mother!
Kip had been watching the town burn for several minutes, but he hadn't thought about anything. His mother was in there. He had to go to her. How was he going to get into the town? Even if he could get past the soldiers in the fire, was his mother even still alive? The king's men had seen the direction he had run away, too. They'd think that the drafter they'd seen earlier was the only threat in the whole area. Surely they would be watching for him. In fact, they might have men out hunting him now. If so, perching on the highest point in the orange grove was probably not the smartest thing to do. It might have been a deer. Evening was coming on, after all. There were lots of deer in the orange groves after...
Talking deer?
Kip dropped to his stomach. He couldn't breathe. He couldn't move. They were going to kill him. Just like they'd killed the Del Claras. Mikhail Del Clara was big, tough as old oak. And they'd slaughtered him.
Move, Kip. Just move.
His heart was a riot in his chest. He was shaking.
Slow down, Kip. Breathe.
There was a cave not far from here. Kip had found his mother there once, after she disappeared for 3 days. There'd long been rumors of smugglers' caves in the area, and whenever his mother ran out of haze and money, she went looking for them. She'd finally gotten lucky about 2 years ago and found enough of the drug that she hadn't come home. When Kip had found her, she hadn't eaten for days. She'd nearly died. He'd overheard someone saying aloud that they wished she had, for his sake. Reaching the ground, Kip started jogging, trying to keep the ruin between himself and the man he'd hurt. He ran about as fast as Sanson would run, if Sanson carried another Sanson on his back. So Kip jogged, trying to be quiet, zigzagging through the straight rows of trees. The sound froze his bones to the marrow.
Dogs!
Fueled by fear, Kip found a flat-out run. He ignored the burning in his legs, the stabbing in his lungs. He was already headed toward the river. The cave was on its banks.
Keep those dogs on the lead! You want to find a drafter while it's still light out?
It was getting darker by the minute, so that was why he was still alive. With all colors muted by darkness, drafters weren't nearly as powerful at night. And between the smoke and a bank of black clouds rolling in, the sky was darkening faster than normal. If they'd let the dogs go, they'd have run them down already. But with darkness coming on so fast, they might feel safe to let them go at any minute. Suddenly, Kip was on the riverbank. He stepped on one pant leg and almost fell down, barely catching himself with one hand. He stopped. The cave was upstream, away from town, not 200 paces away. He picked up two stones that fit nicely in his hands. If he had the cave to protect his sides and back, he could... what?
Die slowly?
He looked at the rocks in his hands.
Rocks.
Against soldiers and war dogs. He was stupid. Insane. He looked at the rocks again, then threw one onto the opposite bank of the river, downstream. He threw the second rock farther. Then he grabbed two more, rubbed them against his body, and threw them as far as he could. The last one crashed through the branches of a willow tree. Lousy throw. No time to mourn his ineptitude. Kip's scent trail already was headed upstream, the direction he did need to go. He'd just have to hope. It was a pathetic attempt, but he had nothing else. He kept moving upstream up the bank, trying to ignore the sound of the barking dogs closing in. Then he stepped into the river, careful not to let his clothes touch any dry rocks. The place where he had come to the river was a bend, so soon he was out of the line of sight.
Let the dogs go!
Then Kip was opposite the cave entrance. It was invisible from the river, obscured by boulders that had fallen in front of the opening. But as soon as he stepped out of the river, he'd be leaving scent for the dogs and a visual trail of wet rocks for the soldiers. He couldn't get out of the water. Not yet. He looked up at the black clouds.
Oh, don't just sit there! Give me some rain!
What's the problem? What's wrong with them?
They're fighting dogs, sir, not trackers. I'm not even certain they're on the drafter's trail.
Kipt kept pushing upstream another 100 paces, where the bend in the river straightened out, and a tree had fallen down the bank into the water. It wouldn't do anything for the scent trail, but it would hide the water he was dripping. He cut up the bank and then stopped. If he headed back downstream, he'd be going closer to the men hunting him. But the soldier's mention of other trails had put a small, desperate hope in Kip's breast. Other trails meant maybe other, fresh trails. And if it weren't for the dogs, the cave would be the safest place to spend the night. Swallowing so his heart didn't jump out of his throat, Kip turned downstream toward the cave. He thought he felt a cool prick on his skin.
Rain?
He looked back up at the black clouds, but it must have been his imagination. He came to the spot overlooking the cave's entrance. Two soldiers were standing almost directly below him. Two others were on the opposite bank. There was one war dog on each side. Either dog's head would have come up to Kip's shoulder easily. They both wore studded leather coats like horse armor, without the saddle. Kip dropped to the ground.
Sir, if I may, the drafter came straight to the river, then veered sharply upstream before going in the water. He knows we're following. I think he doubled back and went downstream.
With us so close behind?
He must have heard the dogs.
The rain is coming. We might only have one shot at this. Let's make it fast.
The man gestured for the men on the other side of the river to head downstream. They took off at a jog. Kip's heart started beating again. He slipped down the bank beside two great boulders. There was a narrow space between the two. It looked like it went in for about 4 paces and then stopped, but Kip knew that it turned sharply. He never would have discovered it the first time if it hadn't been for the pungent, sickly sweet odor of haze floating out. Orholm knew how his mother had ever found it. Now, even knowing it was there, Kip almost didn't have the courage to push between those rocks. There was something wrong, though. It wasn't as dark as it should be. It was fully night outside, and Kip was blocking the entrance. So someone was already inside, and they had a lantern. He pushed around the corner and into the open space of the smuggler's cave. There were two figures sitting in the wan light of a lantern, Sanson and Kip's mother. Both were covered in blood. His mother was seated against the wall of the cave, her once blue dress dyed black and red with blood, dried and fresh. Lena's dark hair was matted, darker than normal, stringy with blood. The right side of her face was pristine, perfect. All the blood was coming from the left side of her head, traveling down her hair like a wick, blooming on her dress. Sanson sat next to her, his eyes closed, head back, clothes almost as gory. His mother's eyes fluttered. There was a huge dent in the side of her head. Orholm, be merciful. Her skull was shattered. She stared in his direction for several moments before she found him. Her eyes were a horror to behold. The pupil of her left eye was dilated, the right a tight pinprick, and the whites of both were completely bloodshot.
Kip, never thought I'd be so happy to see you.
Love you too, Mother.
My fault.
Her eyes fluttered and closed. Kip's heart seized. Was she dead? Before today, he'd never seen anyone die. Orholm, this was his mother. He looked at Sanson, who looked healthy, despite all the blood on his clothes.
I tried, Kip. The Akadesa wouldn't listen. I told her.
Even his own family didn't believe him. Even when the soldiers rode down his mother and split his brother open, Aiden Martyr stood there, arguing how a satrap wouldn't possibly do such a thing to his own people. Only Sanson ran away. Who would have thought he was the smart one in that family?
Mother, enough!
You came back, though, didn't you, Sanson? Tried to save me unlike my own son. Too bad he didn't try and help me like you tried to help your family. Or I might still have a chance.
Mother, stop! You're dying!
Sanson says you're a drafter now. Funny. All your life, you're a disappointment. And you learned a giraffe today. Too late for any of us. Kill him, Gib. Kill the bastard.
Lena lifted a narrow filigreed rosewood jewelry case as long as Kip's forearm from the floor of the cave beside her. Kip had never seen it before. Kip took the case and opened it. There was a dagger inside, double-edged, of an odd material, starkly white like ivory, with a thread of black winding down the center to the point, and no other adornment save for 7 diamonds embedded in the blade itself. It was the most beautiful thing Kip had ever seen, and he didn't care. He had no idea what the blade was worth, but the case it had come in alone would have paid for a month of his mother's binges.
Mother, what is this?
And I thought Sanson was slow. Put it in his rotten heart. Make that bastard suffer. Make him pay for this.
Mother, what are you saying?
You're a stupid, stupid boy, Kip. But maybe a dull sword can go where a sharp one wouldn't be allowed.
Her head drooped to her chest, and Kip thought she was dead, but her eyes opened once more, only one focusing, locking Kip in her glare. Her fingernails dug into his forearm, painfully.
You go. Go train to be a drafter. Go to the Grimaria. You learn what you need, but don't you forget me. Don't you forget this. Don't listen to him, you hear me? He's a liar. You will not fail me in this, Kip. You learn, and then you kill him. You understand?
Yes, Mother.
Kip, if you ever loved me, avenge me. Swear it by your worthless soul, Kip. Swear it, or I swear to Olam, I'll haunt you. I won't.
Kip looked over at Sanson, who stared back silently, horrified. Kip's mother's fingernails dug in deeper, and her seeing eye seemed almost aflame, demanding his attention. His promise.
I swear to avenge you, Mother, by my very soul.
Something like peace stole over her features, softening the hard planes. Her hand dropped from Kip's forearm, leaving bloody tracks.
I won't let you down, Mother! I'll go right... She's dead.
Kip stared at her woodenly, inexplicably numb. He closed her awful, bloodshot eyes.
Are you hurt?
Huh? Me?
No, genius. I'm talking to the dead person.
It was cruel, thoughtless. Sanson's eyes welled up with tears.
I'm sorry, Kip. I tried to get her out. I was too late.
No, Sanson. No, I'm sorry. Don't talk like that. It's not your fault. Listen to me. We need to act right now, not think. We're in danger. Are you hurt?
No. This blood is all... No, I'm fine.
Then we need to go right now while it's dark and raining. They've got dogs. They can track us. It's our only chance.
But, Kip, where are we going to go?
Odd. Just like that, Kip was the leader. Was it that he'd found some new well of strength? Or was Sanson just that weak?
No, don't even think like that, Kip. He trusts you. Can't that be enough? What if I'm not worthy of trust? I'm going to be a drafter, I guess. So we need to get to the sea. We should be able to find a ship in Garriston that's going to Chromeria.
Sanson's eyes widened, obviously thinking about what Kip's mother had sworn him to.
How do we get to Garriston?
We float the river first.
Kip realized then that he'd lost the purse Master Danavis had given him. He didn't even know when. So even if they made it down the river, they wouldn't be able to pay for the trip to the Chromeria.
Kip, the soldiers were in a big circle around the whole town. If they're still like that, we'll have to cross through their line twice. And the town's still on fire, the river could be blocked.
Sanson was right, and for some reason that made Kip suddenly furious. He stopped himself. This wasn't Sanson's fault. Kip's eyes felt hot. It was so hopeless. He blinked rapidly.
Well, I know it's stupid, Sanson, but I don't have any other ideas. Do you?
I saw some dead wood on the bank that might work.
Then let's go.
Kip, do you want to
I don't know. Say goodbye?
Sansa nodded in the direction of Kip's mother. Kip swallowed, holding the knife case in a white-knuckled grip.
And say what? I'm sorry I was a failure, a disappointment, that I loved you, even though you never loved me. No. Let's go.
The boys crept out of the cave. Kip went first. Apparently that was the price of becoming the leader. Kip had been under these same stars on the river dozens of times. But tonight, there was hunger in the cool air. The wind had changed direction. And now the smells of the light misting rain opening the earth mingled with wood smoke and the faint fresh fragrance of the oranges ripening on the trees. Always before, the scent had cheered Kip. Tonight it was faint, ephemeral, as fragile as Kip's chances. They made it to the river's edge without seeing any soldiers. They'd floated the river before, all four of them grabbing a few planks of wood for extra buoyancy, but mostly just lying back and letting the current carry them. But they'd always waited until late fall, when the river was lower. Even then, they'd all sported dozens of scrapes and bruises from the rocks they couldn't avoid. It was the middle of summer now, and though the river was lower than in the spring, it was still high and swift. That meant that they would be able to float over rocks that would scrape them in the fall, but the rocks they couldn't avoid, they would hit much faster. Sanson found the sticks he'd seen before, while Kip waited anxiously, trying to peer downriver for any hint of the soldiers. The clouds over the village were glowing orange, lit by the fires below them. Sanson returned with a few branches. Not enough for both of them. The boys looked at each other.
You take them. I float better than you do. What do we do if they see us?
Kip's nerve almost failed him as he thought about it. What could they do? Run away? Swim away? Even if they made it to the banks of the river, where could they go? The town was on fire, and there were only fields around town. Men on horses with dogs helping them would find Kip and Sanson in no time.
Play dead. After all, we shouldn't be the only bodies in the water.
Actually, that wasn't true. This far upstream, they should be the only bodies in the water. If any of the soldiers realized that, the boys would quickly become real corpses. The water was cold even this far from the mountains, but it wasn't freezing. Kip sat down in it, and the current began pulling him toward town. Sanson followed. They were pulled around the first bend and approaching the spot where Kip had first come to the river, when he saw the flaw in his plan. To play dead meant that in the sections of river that were most dangerous, the places where he and Sanson would most want to see or listen to find out if they'd been discovered, they'd have to keep their ears submerged and their eyes fixed on the clouds above. If they were discovered, Kip's plan guaranteed that they wouldn't know it until too late. They should get out of the water. He couldn't do this. Kip glanced back. Sanson was already lying back, floating on his back, ears covered, limbs loose. He'd been pulled over to the other side of the river, and the current had already brought his lighter body even with Kip. Kip's heart hammered. If he got out now, Sanson wouldn't know it. Kip wouldn't be able to grab his friend without making so much noise that it would rouse anyone within hundreds of paces.
Yes, Your Majesty. We think the draft had climbed up into that tree. The dogs tracked him that far and lost him.
Kip saw the torch first. Someone was approaching the bank of the river, not 5 paces downstream. His first thought, to run like hell, would get him killed. He swept his arms once, twice, paddling downstream. Then he lay back. The cold water closed over his ears. The bank here was raised a pace and a half, high enough that even lying back, Kip could see the man. Kip wasn't 2 paces away, and the torch the man held illuminated an imperious face in its flickering orange light. Even warmed in torchlight, there was something fundamentally cold about that face, an unpleasant smirk hiding in the corner of that mouth. The king, for Kip had no doubt, even in half a second of seeing him, that this man was King Haradul, was not yet out of his 20s, but already half bald, with the rest of his hair combed to his shoulders. He had a prominent nose over a tight, immaculate beard and thick black brows. The king stared upstream, a vein on his forehead visible even in the torchlight, gazing at the opposite bank where Kip had crossed. Then the king turned just as Kip was starting to get downstream of him, and he turned left, toward Kip. Kip didn't move a muscle. But it wasn't because he was being smart. He felt warmth blooming in the cold water between his legs. It was only the torch directly between the king and Kip that saved the boys. His eyes went right over them, but blinded by that light in the darkness, he saw nothing. He turned and disappeared. Kip floated down the river, head back, almost disbelieving that he was alive. The water was cold around him. The stars were pinpricks in Orholm's mantle above. They were more beautiful than he'd ever realized. Each star had its own color, its own hue. Brilliant rubies, startling sapphires, and even here and there, an elusive emerald. For perhaps 20 paces, Kip floated in utter peace, enwrapped by the beauty. Then, he hit a rock. He flailed, freezing with fear, as his head came clear of the water, and he realized how loud he'd been. A little way down the river, Sanson had pulled his head out of the water and was staring at Kip with horror. How could Kip make so much noise? Kip looked away, ashamed. They floated in silence for a long minute, staring into the darkness, waiting to see if any soldiers would appear. They did their best to avoid the rocks, legs pointed downstream, hands paddling in little circles to keep themselves afloat. But no one came. They floated as close together as they could, though Kip knew it was unwise. Two bodies floating separately might not be remarkable, but two floating side by side? Still, he didn't move away. Silence settled over the boys as they came closer and closer to the bridge where their friends had died that morning. It seemed so long ago now. And then Kip saw her, lying on the riverbank. The soldiers who'd murdered Issa had pulled their arrows out of her body. But aside from turning her over, they hadn't moved her corpse. She lay on her back, eyes open, head turned left toward Kip, dark hair waving in the river. One arm was raised over her head, not drifting in the current, but instead, stiff as a felled tree. The underside of her arm, and even her face, was a horrific dark purple with pooled blood. Kip put his feet down on the slick rocks of the riverbed to go to her. He was about to stand when some sixth sense stopped him. He hesitated, and still lying in the water, looked around as much as he could. There, standing on the bridge with only his head visible, the soldier kept watch. So they weren't stupid. They'd figured that whoever this drafter was that they'd run into earlier, he'd have the decency to come back and bury his friends. The current was carrying Kip downstream. No decision was a decision. But what could he do? Face soldiers? If there was one, there might be 10. And if 10, maybe 100. Kip was no fighter. He was a child. He was fat, weak. One man would be one man too many. Kip turned away from Issa's corpse and lay back in the water once more. He didn't want to remember like this anyway. A knot formed in his throat, so hard and so tight it threatened to strangle him. Only his fear of the soldier above kept him from crying as he floated under Green Bridge. He didn't even think of the dagger in its ornate case strapped to his back until they were far downstream. He could have tried. He could have at least gotten out of the water and taken a look. Issa deserved more. Soon they were drifting into town, where the river flowed in a narrower, deeper channel, lined on each side with great rocks, and crossed at intervals by sturdy wood bridges. Parts of the town were still on fire, though Kip didn't know whether that was because they were built of materials that were less flammable, or because the fire had spread more slowly through some areas and was only reaching some buildings now. Soon, they encountered their first corpse, a horse. Still harnessed to a wagon full of late-season oranges, it had been trapped in a section of the town that was now smoldering. Maddened by the fire, the mare had leapt into the river. The wagon had followed and either crushed or drowned it, spilling oranges everywhere. They came closer to the water market, and it kept getting hotter. There were fires still burning ahead. The water market was a small circular lake that was dredged regularly to keep a uniform depth. It was said that once both river and town had been much larger. The river, supposedly, had been navigable from below the falls all the way to the Cerulean Sea, and then from Recton all the way to the mountains, bringing traders from all of the seven satrapies, hungry for Tyria's famous oranges and other citrus fruits. Now, only the smallest flat-bottomed boats could make the trip downstream, and the number of robbers happy to relieve traders of anything valuable convinced most farmers to send their oranges on the slower, heavily armed, and much less profitable caravans. Even the smallest, hardest, and thickest skinned oranges sent by caravans over land would rot long before they could reach the distant courts where nobles and satraps would pay a fortune for such a delicacy. So almost every year, some young farmer tried the river, and a few times they got through, all the way to Garriston, and came home with a fortune, if they managed to avoid the robbers again on the way back. But for the most part, the trade for which the water market had been built was long dead. The townsfolk kept it for pride and for their own use. All the roads were already built around the water market, all their storehouses surrounded. So they maintained the barges and floated around the circle every market day, according to rules and an etiquette that no outsider could hope to understand. In the middle of the water market was an island, connected by a drawbridge to the north shore. As they came fully inside of the island, Kip saw where the screams had come from. The drawbridge was down, and the island was filled with hundreds of animals trapped by the fires closing in around them. Even the drawbridge, straining with the weight of dozens of horses, sheep, pigs, and a grotesque carpet of rats, was smoking at one end. Eyes rolling in fear, the brickmaker's draft horse looked like it was on the verge of bolting, though where it would go was impossible to say. The animals filled the island to overflowing. They were packed shoulder to flank over the entire little circle and the bridge. Kip was so absorbed in the spectacle that he began floating right into the middle of the river between the docks and the island.
Master, it's so hot!
Kip thrashed and turned. On the raised bank of the market circle stood a young man, a little older than Kip. The young man wore only a red loincloth. His curly black hair and bare chest glistened with sweat. He was looking over his shoulder, apparently to a man behind him. Kip could see nothing of that man. But he didn't wait. Kip thought they must have heard him when he thrashed, but apparently the roar of the fires drowned out the sound. Motioning to Sanson, Kip swam toward the wall. Sanson followed. Kip and Sanson clung to the wall with their bodies pressed as close to it as they could, looking up.
What's this?
A whirling lasso of fire spun into view over their heads and then flicked forward. It wrapped around one post of the drawbridge and stuck there. The rest of the rope flared out of existence, but that length stayed, smoldering. Little wisps of flame escaping against the wood, splinters turning black and curling back, smoking. Kip was at once horrified and captivated. In all the years he'd spent helping Master Danibus, the drafter had never done anything like this.
Now, you try!
For a moment, nothing happened. Kip looked over at Sanson. Both of them were stuck to the wall, arms spread wide to get good holds on the stone so they wouldn't have to tread water. Kip had the sudden feeling that they'd been set up. The drafter knew they were here. He just told his apprentice that, so Kip and Sanson would stay in place. They were going around. He should swim right now, as fast as he could. Sanson returned his gaze, his own eyes worried, but not understanding what Kip was thinking. Then, a wheel of flame spun out above them. The wheel drew back and unraveled, becoming a whip. Somewhat like what the master drafter had sent out just a minute before, but much, much larger. This was the youth's work? The whip snapped out, but not at the post of the drawbridge. Instead, it cracked as it snapped on the flank of the brickmaker's draft horse. Crazed with pain and fear, the old beast surged forward. The horse ran directly into the rail of the drawbridge. The rail cracked and broke open. Several pigs and thin-coated sheep fell into the water. The draft horse tried to stop, suddenly aware of the drop, but its hooves scraped wood for only a moment before it plunged headfirst into the water.
What was that? Was that what I told you to do?
Quickly, Kip looked from the animals in the water to the bridge. The bridge post was just starting to catch fire in earnest now. Once it climbed up to the drawbridge, the animals would go crazy, just as the horse had. Kip didn't think the drawbridge itself would catch fire quickly, but he couldn't be sure. If he and Sanson wanted to get out of the water market and out of the burning town, the fastest way was to go under the straining bridge in front of them and directly over the waterfall to head downriver. The other way would be to go the long way around the circular lake, exposed to the eyes of the drafter and his apprentice above them the whole time. Either way they went, at some point they would be visible.
You never go beyond my orders, Simon! Do you understand?
The drafters were distracted. It was now or never. Kip nodded at Sanson, who looked bewildered, and launched off the wall, swimming toward the drawbridge. Gavin drafted a blue platform, thin, barely visible against the water it floated on.
You did that just to make me nervous, didn't you?
Gavin grinned and stepped onto the skull. He extended a hand to Karis, giving her a little bow. She ignored his hand and hopped aboard. He pulled up the keel as she landed, so the skull zipped out from under her feet. Gavin caught her with a cushion of softer green Luxon that quickly morphed into a seat. He lifted the seat and placed it on the front of the skull, then bound both of their packs to the skull near his feet.
Gavin, I am not going to sit while you...
She tried to stand, and he threw the skull forward. She shot a look back at him, peeved and amused at once.
I thought you'd like being swept off your feet.
You had your chance for that.
His grin dropped into the waves like so many other treasures and disappeared. Karis looked dismayed.
Gavin,
No, I deserved that. Please, go ahead and stand.
16 years. You'd think that they'd have both moved on. Not that they hadn't both tried.
Thank you.
Kara stood up, feet wide, knees slightly bent. The skull was propelled by banks of little oars jutting out from each side. Through generations of study, green and blue drafters had figured out how to use gears and wheels and chains to drive the oars, each drafter customizing his craft to fit his own body so that he could propel it with whatever combination of arm and leg movements he preferred, and making whatever tweaks he thought made it more efficient. Because the craft had so little friction with the water, an athletic drafter could go the speed of a sprinting man for an hour. That was fast, very fast. But it wasn't nearly as fast as Gavin had promised. Still, he leaned fully forward, his body suspended in a web of Luxon, arms and legs pumping. He elongated and narrowed the skull so it became a dagger knifing over the water's face. They attained full speed as they left the harbor. Gavin was sweating, but it was a good, clean feeling. The wind blew in his face, carrying away any words either he or Karis might have said. And without words, there was simply her presence. The sight of her dark hair whipping in the sea wind, the strong lines of her face, skin glowing in the morning light, chin lifted, neck extended, enjoying the freedom as much as he was. Karis was facing forward, so she didn't see him draft the Luxon scoops into the water. Gavin had always thought there had to be a better way. After all, a drafter could throw a fireball at any speed. It was only dependent on will. If he threw something too big or too fast, of course, he might hurt himself from absorbing the kick. But skulls didn't take advantage of will. They were instead perfect rowing watercraft that used muscle power more efficiently than any other machine. Gavin wanted to do better. He wanted to use magic the way a sail used wind. That had only led to ripping off a mast or two, but he refused to give up. It had been one of his 7 goals when he'd still had 7 years left to live. Learn to travel faster than anyone thinks is possible. The solution had come to him when he was a child, shooting seeds through a reed at his brother's. Air, trapped between a plug and the walls of the reed, could shoot a seed with much greater force than if you'd simply tried to throw it with your hand. After a lot of trial and error, he put the whole reed in the water, opening it at both ends so it traveled fully underwater. He attached another reed diagonally and shot plugs of magic down into the water and then out the back of the reeds. He let the oars drop, and the whole mechanism fell away, Luxon dissolving even as it hit the waves. He put his hands to the reeds. Karis jerked. She squatted deeper to lower her center of gravity, and her hand went instinctively to her attigan, except that it was in her pack. Then, the skull leapt forward. The first great bumps shook everything as Gavin strained to get up to speed, his muscles knotting with effort. But within moments, the skull leveled off, and the tension on Gavin's arms and shoulders eased somewhat. The plugs hit the water in a steady rhythm. The modified skull, what he called his skimmer, barely kissed the waves. There was still physical effort. Gavin was throwing a lot of force into the water, and his arms and shoulders were basically lifting all of his own weight plus Karis's. But magic could be drafted from the whole body, so it was like carrying a heavy pack, with the straps distributing the weight perfectly. Still, in the last year of doing this every day, his shoulders and arms had gotten bigger than in his entire life. Karis turned. Her mouth literally hung open. She stared at the entire contraption, the scoops of blue Luxon giving flexibility throughout with green, with a super flexible sticky red with a plug shut into the reeds so they wouldn't be shattered. She straightened slowly, leaning into the wind, her back against Gavin so that she wasn't creating another windbreak. He felt her shaking and realized she was laughing with delight. The wind blew away the smell of her hair, too, but for a moment, he imagined he could smell it again. It made him ache.
Ha! Watch this!
In the distance, an island appeared. He leaned, and the skimmer veered hard toward it. Indeed, he quickly learned that the skimmer was capable of maneuvering much faster than he could. The real limit was how quickly he could change direction without tearing himself in half. He leaned right and then left, carving beautiful turns on the calm seas. He angled the reeds down, and the skimmer popped over one of the bigger waves, and suddenly, they were airborne. For more than 100 paces, they flew right over the little island. Then they landed like a skipping stone, and were off once more. In the speed and wind and the closeness of Karis, Gavin finally felt free once more. Despite the warmth of the day, the wind was cold, and if Karis didn't quite burrow into him, she did let her body fully relax against his, grateful for his warmth. If she got too cold, he knew, she would draft sub-red, but she was saving her strength. She didn't know what waited for her in Tyria. That he did, at least in part, lent sweetness to the moment. She would read the White's letter, and learn that he'd fathered a child while they were betrothed. Though she now professed no interest in his love life, it had been one of the questions she'd asked when he broke it off.
Is there another woman?
No.
Have there been any other women while we've been betrothed?
No, I swear it.
Karis wouldn't forgive him this time. It had taken years for her to forgive him for breaking their betrothal and refusing to answer why. But this was betrayal. Poor Holum, how he'd miss her. He avoided the shipping lanes and stayed far from shore. Around noon, he saw clouds ahead. It didn't look like a storm, so he guessed that it was the island satrapy of Alita. It was a country of many ports and more pirates. The central government had collapsed decades ago, and now parts of it were ruled by whatever pirate lord was powerful at the moment. Most of the seven satrapies paid tribute to one or another of the pirate lords, enriching them and enabling them to do more piracy. Gavin had no fear of them, but he didn't want to be seen either. While it might be good for the pirates to have another reason to fear the Chromeria, he'd prefer to keep his little invention secret for as long as possible. Besides, he was only using Alita as a landmark. It was a lot of trouble to use an astrolabe, and in the time it took him to calculate their position, he could just skim around it until he found it. Garriston was at the mouth of a large river. It was the busiest port in Tyria, but that wasn't saying much.
Can I try too?
I thought you were saving your strength.
You can't have all the fun.
Because he was behind her, he couldn't see her whole smile, but he saw one dimple and one raised eyebrow. He widened the skimmer's hull so they could stand side by side and handed over the starboard reed. Karis always preferred to draft from her right hand. At first, they were out of sync, and the craft shuddered and strained as they threw the plugs at different speeds and times. He looked over at her, but before he could say anything, she took his right hand in her left. She squeezed a tempo to keep him on the beat, as she used to do when they danced. The memory hit him as if the skimmer had clipped a reef and smashed him into the sea. Karis, 15 years old, before the war. at the yearly Luxlord's ball on top of the Chromeria. Her light blonde hair was long and straight, and as fine and shiny as her green silk dress. Their fathers were in discussion on which of the Gale brothers she would marry. Gavin, the elder brother and likely to become the next Prism, was of course the richer prize. His father, Andros Gale, didn't care about Karis's beauty.
You aren't a beautiful woman? That's what mistresses are for.
But though he didn't care for the boy's preferences, alliances were to be bought as cheaply as possible, and the marriage of his firstborn was the most valuable stone he had to play, Andros Gale was well aware that other families weren't always so calculating. Some fathers were loath to marry their daughters to men they didn't care for. Andros Gale had ordered the younger Dazen to seduce Karis.
There's a servant's room one floor down. Here's the key. 20 minutes after you leave with her, I'll make some pretext for her father and I to speak privately, and we'll come down. I expect to catch you in the act. I'll be surprised, dismayed, furious. I'll most likely strike you. But what is one to do? The passions of youth and so forth. You understand?
Both brothers did. Luxlord Rissom Whiteoak was reputed to be hot-tempered. Andros Gale would strike Dazen first and get himself between the two so Whiteoak didn't try to kill Dazen. But the real point was that if Karis were caught making love with Dazen, her father would have no choice. So as not to shame the Whiteoaks, Karis would quickly be married to Dazen. The families would be allied, and Andros Gale would still have his more valuable elder son to play.
Gavin, I expect you to be pleasant but not encouraging with the girl. If your brother fails the family in this, you will have to marry her.
Yes, sir.
But then the ball had begun. Gavin had taken the first dance with Karis, and the worst possible thing had happened. Holding her petite form against him, her hand in his squeezing out the beat, and looking into her jade green eyes. At the time, she had only the tiniest flecks of red in her irises. Gavin had been enchanted. By the time Dazen came to dance with her, Gavin was in love. Or lust, anyway.
I've been betraying Karis since before we even met.
Karis squeezed his hand harder than she had been. He looked over. Her eyes held a question. He must have tensed, and Karis had caught it. She'd always been deeply physical. She hugged or brushed or touched those she loved all the time. Dancing was as natural to her as walking. She didn't touch Gavin often, anymore. Gavin gave a dismissive smile and shook his head. Karis opened her mouth to speak and paused.
Make the tubes bigger!
A forced laugh. So, she remembered the dance, squeezing out the beat into his hand. Of course she did. But she was letting it go, and he was grateful for it. He widened the reeds as far as they could handle, and soon they were going faster than he'd ever gone by himself. He hadn't meant to show her this next trick, but he couldn't help himself. He knew it would bring her real joy. And what fun is it being a genius if no one appreciates you? He released Karis's hand. This part was the most dangerous. At this speed, running into something deliberately was stupid. And yet...
Brace yourself!
Throwing his right fist forward, Gavin threw Green Luxon out as far in front of him as he could. It landed on the waves. A moment later, the skimmer hit the Green Luxon ramp. In an instant, they were airborne, flying 20 paces above the waves. Gavin released the whole reed apparatus and drafted. The Luxon of the platform shot up his and Karis's backs and then shot out from his arms. They were falling now, 15 paces from the waves, and even if hitting them at this speed meant they would skip rather than just splash, they were still falling 20 paces. The Luxon spun out in every color, trying to form despite the gale force wind. 10 paces to the waves, 5. At this speed, hitting the water would be like hitting granite. Then the Luxon hardened in its shape, which was as much like a condor's wings as Gavin had been able to manage. The wings caught the air, and Karis and Gavin shot into the sky. Of course, it didn't really fly, it glided. He tried to use the reeds, but it hadn't worked so far. For the time being, the condor had a limited range. Karis wasn't complaining. She was wide-eyed.
Gavin! Oh, hold on! Gavin, we're flying!
king!
He'd always loved that about her. Her laughter was freedom for both of them. She'd forgotten about the dance. That made it worth it.
Get in the middle.
He didn't have to shout. They were completely inside the body of the condor.
I'm not very good at turning. Mostly I lean one way or the other.
Indeed. Because he was heavier, they were already turning toward his side. Together, they leaned toward her side until the condor straightened.
The white doesn't know about this, does she?
Only you. Besides,
no one else could do the drafting required.
Galeeb and Tarkian are probably the only polychromes who could handle all the colors necessary, and neither of them is fast enough. If I can make it easy enough for other drafters, I might tell them.
Might?
I've been thinking about the ways this could be used. In war, mostly. The seven satrapies already fight and scheme over the few polychromes there are. This would make it 100 times worse.
Is that Garriston?
She was looking north and west.
Already?
The real question is whether you want to crash onto land or into the water.
Crash?
I'm not very good at landing yet. And with so much extra weight...
Excuse me?
What? I haven't tried flying with a manatee aboard either.
Did not just compare me to a sea cow.
No, it's just that all the extra weight.
After all this time, Gavin, I still get you.
Despite the laughter, the pain went deep.
And I still don't get you.
Maybe she would have been happy with Dazen.